Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Do not tempt me. Of course, I'm not going to take my shirt off on my special.
I'd be on stage every night, and it kept going into my head, like, you could take your shirt off right now and just talk about airplanes and just silly, almost, you know, stuff that would be maybe considered hacky material. And I kept telling myself no, and then I finally just thought, no, I think I should do this.
Welcome to That Scene with me, Dan Patrick, an Amazon original podcast where I get to talk to Hollywood's top actors and directors about some of the most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's show, we're joined by comedian, actor, and producer Tig Notaro. Tig was born in Jackson, Mississippi in 1971, began her career in entertainment as a band manager in Denver, Colorado in the 90s, and by the end of the decade, she had made her way to Los Angeles and began a career in stand-up. On June 30th, 2012, Tig was diagnosed with cancer in both of her breasts. And 4 days later, she shared this news live on stage at Largo in Los Angeles. The set was described as instantly legendary. Tig subsequently received a double mastectomy, removing both her breasts and leaving her chest scarred. The scene in question today is during Tig's 2015 stand-up special, Boyish Girl Interrupted, where during the last 15 minutes of the special, Tig takes off her shirt, showing the scars from her double mastectomy. When you're crafting a Boyish Girl Interrupted, you decide you're going to take off your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
At what point in the process of putting that special together did you say, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take off my blouse.
As soon as I got home from the hospital after my double mastectomy, I kept thinking about when am I going to be able to work again or get back to life? And when am I going to be able to do stand-up? And when I pictured myself doing stand-up, I started laughing and thinking, oh my gosh, what if I did stand-up with my shirt off? And I thought it was so funny. And because I knew it would make people uncomfortable, but I wanted to not take it too seriously and try and make deep, dark, or intense jokes around it, I thought, I think it'd be a real statement to take my shirt off. But I also thought, as a comedian, I want to make sure it's funny, too. So I thought the combination of taking my shirt off and talking about flying on an airplane and never acknowledging that my shirt was off would be the way to go. And then I thought, no, I can't do that. That's insane. I can't do that. And so I'd push it out of my head. And then it kept coming up for me, especially once I got out on the road and I started touring and I'd be on stage every night. And it kept going into my head, like, you could take your shirt off right now and just talk about airplanes and just silly, almost, you know, stuff that would be maybe considered hacky material. And I kept telling myself no. And then I finally just thought, no, I think I should do this.
I'll tell you, I am afraid to fly. And I am, sure, laugh all you want. But I'm very afraid to fly. And I went on a plane that seated maybe only six people. And it was so tiny that you could only kind of crouch to get through the plane. And oh my God, it was so small. And once we got to our cruising altitude, we're flying along, and the pilot, who's just sitting right there, it's just like, hey, how's it going? And you do your thing, I'll do mine. He gets out of his seat and just is like, let me show you where the emergency toilet is. And I said, I'll decide where the emergency toilet is.
What do you want people to notice about that moment?
I want people to notice that I lived through what I lived through. And also, we're going to live through this moment of me taking my shirt off, that as terrifying or awkward or weird and crazy as it might seem, it's really not that insane. Because I talk about this all the time. People have scars on their face and you're not like, oh my gosh, cover your face, put a bag over your head. You have a scar on your face, you know? Before I had my double mastectomy, I was so scared to Google images of what it would look like, what my body would look like. I was so scared. And once I went through that and I lived and saw that my scars just show that I healed. That's great. That's great news. And let me show you to not be scared of this. Yes, these are unfortunate circumstances, but one of the greatest things, the feedback that I got was from a lot of times from people that were not cancer survivors, and they weren't even women. A lot of men would say, what I walked away from was thinking, this is about just the human body and to be comfortable in your own skin. And to me, that meant so much. Of course, it means so much that it meant something to women or to cancer survivors or people with scars in whatever areas of their bodies. But it really struck me when men said that to me.
How many people tried to talk you out of doing it?
Only one. And I think it was out of care for me. It's funny because he said, you know, I'm scared that this is going to come across as a stunt or, yeah. And I said, it is. It is a stunt. It's like, it's a total stunt. I want people to talk about this. So many jokes are stunts. It's a stunt. Make no mistake. And after I did it, he was like, I was wrong. It's incredible.
And when I watch, I know what's going to happen. But at some point, then I just start listening to you again.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, like a couple of minutes in, I'm just listening to you. Like, it's not that I'm focusing on your scars.
Yeah.
I go back to listening to you and watching you.
That's the point. Is I, even before I did it, I had confidence that I understood what it was like to process that. I thought a lot about this. I think I just knew in my gut that there's no way if my shirt comes off and I have two scars across my chest that the audience is going to be hijacked by that for the rest of the show. There's just no way. People adapt and they move on, just like I adapted to my body and I've moved on and people adapted to seeing my body like that. And so many people in the audience have been through it. They have a loved one that's been through it, a friend. It's that you're going to connect to that moment in a different way. There's plenty of people that hated it or thought, you know, it wasn't funny, it wasn't okay. But I have no regrets. I would say the majority of people were okay with it.
I love that you were flirty. Like, oh, you don't want me to? I loved it. I love that moment where you're just kind of toying with us a little bit.
Yeah.
The first reaction from the crowd, though, was what? First time you did it?
I did it before I taped my HBO special. I did it at Town Hall in New York. And the first time I did it, people just went nuts. They were so into it. They were so supportive. And it was just like, yes! It was that kind of like, yes! And I would say in general, that was the vibe also for my HBO special. I think there was also that evening was layered with the fact that there was a taping going on. And before tapings, you know, the audience is told to stay seated and to not get up and to not do certain things. And but there was no doubt the exact same vibe the night of the HBO special as when I tried it out at Town Hall in New York.
Where does dark humor come from?
like so much humor, processing and making it open to a conversation about a situation or an experience. I mean, when things get so dark or uncomfortable, you really need that break in the tension. And it feels like fight or flight, those kind of moments, like it has to happen. And you just go to wherever your head tells you.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you allow yourself to feel sorry for yourself before you get to that dark humor?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure it's a mix of sorry for myself or scared or hurt or whatever it is. All of those different emotions. That's the beauty of time, of being able to have a laugh at something that really seemed impossibly funny.
But you know what's nice about all of this is that you can always rest assured that God never gives you more than you can handle. Never. Never. When you've had it, God goes, all right, that's it. I just keep picturing God going, you know what? I think she can take a little more. And then the angels are standing back going, God, what are you doing? You are out of your mind. And God was like, no, no, no. I really think she can handle this.
I don't know if you went from observational humor to personal humor. But was there a transition or a moment where you went, I'm going to change and now it's going to be about this, it's going to be about my body, it's going to be about me and my personal life?
When I first started doing stand-up, it was very rigidly delivered and quiet. And then I started to allow myself to tell longer jokes or stories, and it was still observational and some personal things peppered in here and there. But for the most part, it was observational. And it wasn't until 2012 when I was diagnosed with cancer and I had an intestinal disease and pneumonia and all these things at one time, including the accidental death of my mother and my breakup with my girlfriend. It all happened in this 4-month period of time.
Wow.
I decided that I would go on stage and try and make light, make sense of what I was going through. I did that because it felt like a very impossible time to go on stage and just make jokes about what I had observed and the silliness of life around me. I didn't know if I was going to live. I didn't know what was going to happen. It wasn't even a real clear decision that I made. It just was instinctual that I just felt like I needed to share this and try and break some sort of tension and get on the other side of things.
like when I was walking to the grocery store and I was just like, what am I doing? Why am I even buying food? Why am I trying to sustain this? Nourish my body just to stick around to get more bad news? Gotta keep myself alive so my ears work and I can hear horrible things. Certainly this can't be all.
Once I did that, it felt so great and it actually changed me as a person and I think made me more open in my relationships and with other people. And not that all of my comedy is always personal or around heavy things, but to have that option now and to use that when I need to or want to, it's nice rather than to feel like, no, I'm not talking about my personal life. I'm not sharing any of this or I'm not, you know, it's finding the balance now between the silly observations of life and balancing that with, you know, here's a story about when I was bleeding internally.
But I almost feel like I'm eavesdropping on a therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was a goal, but I did feel like I'm listening to something very intimate, but you're allowing us to, but I still felt like I was eavesdropping.
Yeah, it's certainly therapeutic to share and to get a warm response from a bunch of strangers.
Did you know how cathartic it would be?
No, I didn't have a clue. I thought that I might regret it. I thought I might bomb. I thought I might have a really awkward show and then head off and back into life and just die and never be seen or heard from again. And I had no idea what was, I didn't know if people were going to demand for refunds. I truly didn't know. But when you lose everything and you have nothing to lose, you just take a risk that you wouldn't normally. It's that fight or flight kind of moment.
Somebody over here just keeps going, oh. Oh, I think she might really have cancer. Who's taking this really bad? Oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's gonna be okay. It might not be okay, but I'm just saying. It's okay. You're gonna be okay. I don't know what's going on with me.
Do you have somebody as a sounding board who will say, let me give you a true assessment of what I see or what I hear? That will go, like my wife will always say, let me be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
Do you have that person who will go, hey, this is what I saw, this is what I liked, this is what I didn't like?
Before I met my wife, Stephanie, I probably relied more on comedians in the comedy community. Not just relied on it, but it was just a part of my world because I was hanging out more in comedy clubs on a nightly basis. And so I would get that feedback and I would give that feedback to others. But once I met Stephanie 8 or 9 years ago, she happens to be one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. And I trust her comedic sensibilities because she's an improviser. She does sketch and she's an actor and writer and director, all of those things. And so she, I would say, more than anybody, I rely on to get my feedback. And she's typically right about that stuff.
She's not right about everything.
Not about everything.
Yeah.
No.
I was wondering about comedians. And you hear laughter. Sometimes people feel like it's the obligatory laugh. Like you're seeing a comedian, you're supposed to laugh. But the body language sometimes might tell you a different story about how your humor is going over. Do you read the audience? Is it the audible or is it the visual?
I'm sure it's a little bit of both, but I'd say mainly the audible. It's just this extra sense that you have as a comedian. You can feel a room. You can tell when things are genuinely going well.
Your body doesn't lie. you can laugh and you can give a courtesy laugh. It's hard. Like, your body's just going to do what it wants to do when it hears something like that.
Right. But you can hear it in a courtesy laugh, too. A courtesy laugh. It's worse than not getting a laugh, I think.
I love music. I've never detected a punchline there. Maybe I should listen more. Sounded like a cartoon character showed up. I can barely take this. I'm laughing so hard. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. It's like, oh, come on, that wasn't funny.
Yeah. Yeah, just I don't want the help. I would rather I'd rather the uncomfortable silence.
There's a cadence to your delivery, and it's always the audience. You're waiting for the audience to catch up. Like, it's going to be there, and they're like a second or 2 seconds off. And I love how you wait for them, and then you almost, like, you give a dog a treat. You go, okay, all right. Like, you kind of caught up to me.
Uh-huh.
Is that by design? That, like, how do you come up with a rhythm or a cadence?
You know, there's always been the similarity between comedy and music. A lot of musicians want to be comedians. A lot of comedians want to be musicians. And there's a beat, a count. And it's similar to, I think, when musicians write music. You don't necessarily set out to write in a certain way. I always call it a brain stamp. When I think about somebody like Eddie Van Halen, even though he wrote so many different songs over the years, you can hear his brain stamp in there. You can hear when it's Eddie. People can play similarly to Eddie. In fact, we had somebody play similarly to Eddie on the special. It wasn't actually Eddie Van Halen. But when you know Eddie's brain stamp, you can hear it in his music. And it's the same with a comedian. They have their, or any type of artist, I think, you have your brain stamp.
When did Eddie Van Halen enter your life?
I remember I was in sixth grade and this girl named Carrie, she was the biggest Van Halen fan. And I remember she played Van Halen's cover of The Kinks, You Really Got Me. And it was truly ear candy to me. I had never heard anything so incredible in my life.
I do love music. And, I would constantly write down all the lyrics to every Beatles song, like put the record on, take the needle off, and write the lyrics down, put the needle back on, just every song, obsessed. And my grandmother ended up having Alzheimer's, and she collected anything that we touched growing up. And towards the end of her life, when I was an adult, she called me into her bedroom, and she pulled out this box and this paper. She said, "You wrote this for me when you were little. And it was when I'm 64. And I had to sit there and take credit for a Lennon and McCartney tune." It's like, oh, that's right. I forgot about that one. You like that, huh? If so, I have a huge catalog of other songs I think you might like.
What is it about certain artists that you just go, how do they do that? Or where's it come from? And I grew up in the era where, you know, I had Jimmy Page and, you know, Zeppelin, Stones, Who, Pete Townsend, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eddie Van Halen, and I had, you know, like battle lines were drawn. Oh, he's better than Jimmy Page. Oh, he's better. No, he's not. And then you listen to what guitar players say about Eddie and, like, that's genius.
I mean, I think Jimmy Page, I think Jimi Hendrix, Eddie Van Halen, all of these different musicians, again, it's that brain stamp, whatever. I hate to keep using it. It's not anything I've really talked about. But I think what's so incredible is, like you're saying, when somebody does something that is so different than what's been done, it stops you in your tracks. There's a therapist that I love listening to, Esther Perel. I don't know if you know who she is, but she thinks about things, about relationships and life and everything so differently than I've ever heard. And I'm just like, where does this come from? She's the Eddie Van Halen of therapy.
Who's the Eddie Van Halen of comedy?
To me, it's Maria Bamford. She's one of my favorites. We came up together in the comedy world. I mean, there's so many different wonderful Eddie Van Halens in comedy. I would just say that she kills me. And when I watch her, I feel foolish to have ever thought that I was a comedian. I truly, she's such a master. She's so doing her own thing. And it's so funny and weird and crazy and smart.
And a lot of those people can't explain how they do what they do.
Yeah.
I asked John McEnroe, I said, how do you do what you do? And he goes, I just do it.
Yeah.
So in their minds, they just do it. They don't. Their job is not to process how I do it. It's just that I do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you overthink?
I overthink a lot of things, but I don't really overthink comedy. I don't think. when I get an idea or something strikes me, I'll just jot it down and remind myself to mention it when I get on stage. I also don't go into situations looking for comedy. You know, a lot of times people will think that, oh, there's a comedian here. She's going to make fun of us or we're going to end up in her show. And no, it strikes me at moments that I wouldn't even imagine that something funny would happen or that I would think, oh, I need to talk about this on stage.
How am I going to date? You know, I was just thinking like, I just was like, what's going to happen to me? Like, how am I possibly, like, what if I went online? Do I go online and just make a profile? I'm single and I would love to meet somebody, but this is just weird timing and just, I have cancer. Serious inquiries only.
Which came first, music or comedy?
Well, I would say comedy just because I was raised by funny people. My mother was hilarious and my stepfather was very funny in a very reserved, buttoned up, dry way. My father was funny. My extended family, their characters. We watched SNL and I Love Lucy and All in the Family and all the 70s sitcoms that I was raised on.
Was there an importance placed on comedy or humor, sense of humor?
Yeah, I mean, to say that was there an importance placed on it kind of makes it seem like, you know, there was a vibe of we have to laugh, you know, but, you know, whereas it was more fluid than that. It was just my mother was so outrageous and funny. And I guess the importance was on not taking things too seriously.
I have a gift for you all. Something that brings me a lot of joy in my life. I want to give it to you so that you can experience the happiness that I do. I love sending text messages to friends of mine at random times of the day that just say, "What's your ETA?" I just love knowing that somewhere across town, somebody is half naked, frantically rifling through emails and text messages, trying to figure out what they agreed to do with me. And they write back, "What?" And then write back, "Yeah, we're all seated, better hurry."
I was also wondering about that when you knew you were funny. Like, does somebody have to tell you you're funny?
I remember one of the most thrilling moments for me in my childhood was when my friend who lived down the street from me told me that her mother told her that I could be a comedian. And I remember my head exploded because I felt very seen. in a way, to have my friend's mother say that about me. Years later, my friend and her mother came to see me in Austin doing a show.
Oh, that's great.
My friend has several siblings, and her youngest sibling, he was so much younger than us. He didn't know me. And years later, he was in the car with his mother, and I came on the radio on NPR, and he was like, oh, I love this story, or I love this comedian. And she said, you know, you know, we know her. She used to live four houses down from you. And he was like, no. She said, yeah. And it was just such an interesting full circle, because I'll never forget how much that meant to me that her mother thought that I could be a comedian.
And a lot of times we'll take the word of somebody else. If your mom said, hey, you can be a comedian, but it's somebody outside your family who says, hey, you can be a comedian. And it resonates a little bit more sometimes because, oh, mom's just being nice. This person doesn't have to say this.
Yeah, for sure. It's a really interesting thing how that happens, because I felt like I could be a comedian because Dana's mother said so. And it turns out Dana's mother was onto something. I can't believe it.
So you have this new comedy special on HBO called Drawn. How do you think you look animated?
Well, I look very different at different moments, but I enjoy it. I love seeing people's interpretations of me different times in my life.
The biggest challenge in doing animation was what?
Once you get to a certain place in the process and you've given your notes and then you move on to the next place, it's very hard to go back and make changes without completely jacking up the budget.
In the animated special, you're asked about where are your boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're in a dumpster somewhere in Hollywood.
An alley in Hollywood. Yeah.
And you have rats there.
Yeah.
Who came up with the idea that the rats were going to be there where your breast may be?
The rats are in there because I say that I picture rats fighting over them, like a tug of war fighting over, you know, who's going to get to chew on this. But that's true. When people would ask, they're like, are they in a jar somewhere? Are they? And I'm like, I truly have no idea. I just picture a doctor tossing them out a window and then landing in some disgusting dumpster. And what else is going to get to it but rats?
Your darkest joke ever was what?
The darkest, most messed up to me was when I first walked out on stage at Largo in 2012 and tried to deliver my entrance like, hello, good evening, where most people would say, how are you doing tonight? You know, some comedians have to say, hi, how are you? Are there any birthdays? Who here is celebrating tonight? Before that show, before I walked out on stage, I was taking a shower and I thought, how am I going to open this set? How am I going to get into this material? And the best way I could think of doing it was to come out and try my best to deliver it lightheartedly. Hello, good evening. How are you doing? I have cancer. How's everybody doing? And to me, it made me laugh maniacally in the shower as I got ready for my show. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't do that. What if people have cancer? What if people in the audience have cancer? And then I thought, wait a minute, I have cancer. This is my story. I can do this. And I'm glad I did, because it broke the ice and it got people laughing and concerned. But yeah, I think that was kind of dark, I guess. I don't know. And then as I'm saying it, I think about also the joke I made on that album called Live, when I talk about the questionnaire that the hospital sent for my family, or for my mother, to fill out about her stay at the hospital. And she died at the hospital. And so I make a joke and I answer all the questions. So I don't know if you know, but a lot of hospitals do that. They send out the questionnaire. How is your stay at the hospital? And it was addressed to my mother. And when I got that questionnaire, I was so furious. I wanted to call the hospital. I wanted to yell at them. There was nothing funny about it to me at all. And then a month later, I was thinking about it, and it struck me as so funny. How was your stay? Was your doctor attentive? How were the noise levels in your room? My mother was in a coma, and she died. That's dark.
Yes, it is.
That's dark.
Yes.
There you go.
I love that. I love that.
Okay.
You do podcasts, so instead of being asked questions, you ask questions. How do you find that kind of reversal?
I enjoy it. Yeah. I mean, I have one podcast that's an advice podcast where I have a guest every week come on and help me answer questions that listeners send in. And we give earnest, but sometimes silly advice, but do try and help people. And then I have another podcast. The advice podcast is called Don't Ask Tig. The other podcast is called Tig and Cheryl True Story. It's a documentary podcast where Cheryl Hines from Curb Your Enthusiasm, she's an old friend of mine. She and I talk about a new documentary every week and pretty much get off track very easily.
I hear your twins are into baseball, but you have no idea about baseball.
I'm learning. I can't even believe that I know some of these players' names. But yeah, my son's just turned 5. And if they are not playing it, they are watching it. They're watching reruns on YouTube of previous years. And as soon as my son Finn wakes up, he gets Stephanie's phone and he looks up the scores from the night before. It's incredible.
Are they playing T-ball?
And they play baseball, though. They don't just play T-ball. And I'll tell you, our neighbors, every backyard surrounding us has about 50 balls in there. We just see every now and then you'll see a ball come over our fence. In fact, our next door neighbors just demolished their house. And before they demolished it, they got up on the garage and threw out 25 baseballs. I mean, my sons, they just turned 5, but they are hitting the ball like you would not believe. It's incredible.
So you have your own version of the movie Sandlot,
which they watch all the time.
Tig, congrats on all the success and, more importantly, your health. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. It was nice to meet you.
New episodes of That Scene are available exclusively on Amazon Music. And all of season one is available wherever you get your podcasts. So make sure you follow us in the Amazon Music app. That Scene with Dan Patrick, created, hosted, produced by me. Our showrunner and producer is Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody. The show is executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood. Our associate producers, Bill Ryan and Marvin Prince. That Scene is an Amazon original and a production of Dan Patrick Productions.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.